All right, Matt, we are continuing with our essential anime picks. This time it's my turn. I'm in the captain's chair this time. And I also wanted to use this as an opportunity to plug my upcoming two books.
Ooh.
Essential Anime, co-written by Samuel Satin, and A Kid's Guide to Anime, also co-written by Samuel Satin, which are both coming out from Hachette Press and Running Kids Press this fall, 2023. They make great stocking stuffers.
Congratulations. Seriously. But it must have been very difficult for you to write a book about kids anime, because when I was a kid, I was watching anime that was like horrifically inappropriate for my age, and that probably made me what I am today.
Just ask your parents' permission if it's okay first, Matt. Mom, Dad, is it okay if I watch Urotsuki Doji, Legend of the Overfiend when I'm 12 years old like I did?
Over and over again with a lot of really fuzzy pauses happening on certain scenes.
Did you just say that or think it, Matt?
Exactly. I don't want to reveal my origin story because that means like psychiatrists will be able to make me normal again. And I don't want that. I never want that.
So in these books, like when I had to pick or help pick essential anime, like I had to think about like, what were the people's choices? They weren't necessarily like my personal deep cut choices. I couldn't do
right.
like a 1,000-word essay on like Golgo 13, the professional, even though I wanted to.
Kids. Sorry, go on.
So I'm going to kick down five titles from the Showa era that I think are pretty essential.
These are the ones you think people should watch to like understand anime. Is that correct?
I'm highly recommending these. I think it's a bit of both, that they're anime that made me, but also that I think people should see as like kind of foundational.
Okay.
They introduce really good artists or really good directors. They're not just like wacky picks. I'm not going to suggest that you actually watch Kurotsuki Doji, because you probably have. And number one is Speed Racer from 1967. Here he comes. Here comes Speed Racer. He's a demon on wheels.
My mom and dad told me not to watch things with demons in them, Patrick. Actually, it has nothing to do with demons. It has to do with car racing, which is a good, wholesome, healthy sport.
It seems like there was a lot of crime and like diamond smuggling and stuff involved in the car races and Speed Racer.
Well, but the thing I love about Speed Racer is that, yes, every crime and happening in the world can be solved with just a really fast car. It's kind of like it lays the groundwork for Knight Rider that way, you know, like where there's no terrorist activity, there's no, you know, political happening that cannot be addressed without a car. So Speed Racer really paved the way for that. Tatsunoko Productions. It's really iconic design and really amazing looking.
I talked to Ipe Kure, who was one of the co-creators of Speed Racer, and he said there were two big influences. And one was Viva Las Vegas, the Elvis movie where he is a car racer in Las Vegas. And the second thing was Goldfinger, the Aston Martin. And they kind of put those two things together and came up with some of the ideas for Speed Racer.
I thought you were going to say Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. The funny thing about Speed Racer is it kind of has a rep in the US for having like really like silly dubbing where the characters are talking really quick. Look at this. Right speed. And, you know, like no spaces between. Actually, it sounds a lot like how we talk, doesn't it?
Calling the Mach 5. Come in, Speed. Trixie calling the Mach 5.
I'm in the middle of a race, Trixie. Don't talk to me now. Can't you wait till it's over?
Speed, listen to me. Eloise's brother Hap has got to win. Please let him.
Why should I let him win? I'm out to win myself. Now sign off and don't bother me.
But Hap must win so that he can pay for the doctors to make his sister well. And besides, Hap would then be hired to manage a big car factory. That would solve all their money problems. Please let him win, Speed.
It doesn't matter to me what his reasons are for wanting to win. I wouldn't be playing fair if I let him win the race on purpose.
But Speed!
I'll see you when the race is over, Trixie.
But Eloise is ill. They must have some money. Please let him win, Speed. Speed! Speed! Speed!
But when I... when I watched Maha Go 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 for the first time on, I believe, a Laserdisc at Michael House's house back in the 1990s, like, it doesn't sound like that at all in Japanese. It's completely normal, for lack of a better descriptive adjective. They speak in normal cadences, you know, for a group of people who fight crime in race cars with monkeys in their trunk. So that artifact of it that we associate with it in the English dub, is as nostalgic as it is not indicative of the original quality.
Yeah, and it's one of the early color anime to come out of Japan, yeah. And it was also one of the first really early kind of global hits. I mean, I know things like Astro Boy and Kimba had hit American TV before, but they didn't have a very long shelf life because once things got into color, they weren't showing no black and white cartoons on TV so much anymore.
No.
And so even though like I didn't see Speed Racer until maybe like the early 80s on TV, it was still in rotation. And additionally, Speed Racer kind of helped make anime more violent. I have this quote here from my book where it says, the consumer watchdog group Action for Children's Television Animation describes Speed Racer as an animated monstrosity that offers viewers the ultimate in crime, evil characters, cruelty, and destruction. And if that's not a ringing endorsement, I don't know what is.
Man. And a really cute girl named Trixie. Isn't she named Trixie? I think so.
So I think everyone knows it to themselves to watch some episodes of Speed Racer. It's still a really charming show. It moves along briskly. And as one of anime's first global hits, I think it's really interesting to see. If you've never seen Speed Racer before, you owe it to yourself to watch one of the early episodes. I'm sure you can find them out there on YouTube or whatever.
Agreed. What's next? What's number two? What's number two on your cartoons for grown-ups?
Number two is Science Ninja Team Gatchaman, 1972, also from Tatsunoko, who brought you Speed Racer, okay? Shown in America as Battle of the Planets. But I think what this show did is it introduced the color-coordinated five heroes from all walks of life who eventually would become, like, Go Ranger, would become the Power Rangers, you know?
It absolutely set the template for that, 100%, no question about it.
And it took kind of the action dramatic elements of Speed Racer and pushed things even harder into like science fiction territory. And there's some amazing stuff there with sort of like Ken the Eagle, the leader of the G-Force team, sort of like finding out the terrible truth about his father. Condor Joe, the second in command, kind of has a dramatic arc. It delivers a lot of really big dramatic moments for like children's entertainment, shall we say.
Tatsunoko had this style that was, it was anime, but it was also deeply, I think, indebted to American comic books that, like, its heroes tended to be the most American superhero style. Like, they're wearing, like, skin-tight, you know, outfits. They're, like, you know, jumping around, running, punching, doing stuff like that, which I think was a big reason why Gatchaman did so well, particularly in the United States, at a time when there wasn't a whole lot of anime on the air. That was, I'm trying to remember if that's the first anime I ever saw as a kid in reruns in the late 70s, early 80s, or it was one of the Force 5 things by Jim Terry, you know, like Starvengers. But it was kind of eye-opening because it was so different from anything that was on American TV. Like, it looked so much better. In America, it's like you had Hanna-Barbera and then there was that. You got Gatchaman. And it's like, whoa, like, where did this come from? It was like, gotcha, man.
And one reason why the show might have been so successful along with Speed Racer is because, you know, while they don't look like American cartoons, they don't look like they're from Japan either. Yes. Like, they don't sit around on tatami mat floors, like, eating, you know, like, sukiyaki or anything like that. The guys who made Gatchaman, Ipikure, they said, like, they worshipped American culture. Like, they grew up in the post-war era, and they would see American movies where people had, like, refrigerators, like, that had, like, ready-made ice cubes, and they're like, you know what? We want that.
Yeah.
But they kind of scrubbed the Japanese-ness, like, out of their own productions and sort of, like, were aiming for this global market before it had even really taken off.
Well, and I think the love affair is mutual because, famously, a couple of decades back now, Alex Ross, the DC Comics artist who is famed for Kingdom Come and doing these kind of like comic book, you know, homages that are done in this almost like, you know, old master oil painting style, did a bunch of art. I think the covers for a Gatchaman comic re-release in the States, and his portrayals of them are both incredibly on model and also really amazingly just realistically done. Just look up Alex Ross Gatchaman if you haven't seen this stuff. It's amazing, amazing kind of cross-cultural pollination happening right on your computer screen.
If you don't get hits for Alex Ross Gatchaman, look up Alex Ross and Battle of the Planets.
Yes, that's how I first saw it, with like all those weird interstitial moments and like characters that didn't exist in the Japanese, like Seven Zark Seven.
And One Rover One.
There are times when I get this strong, urgent need in my capacitators for something, and I'm sure it's love. Of course, I'm very fond of you, One Rover One, but I was thinking of something just a little different.
One Rover One. Yeah, why did every cartoon when we were a kid have to have a talking dog? God, why?
Or
Patrick?
A robot dog, like Dinomutt.
Dinomutt, yes. Dinomutt. You know, Scooby-Doo's a talking dog, kind of. I guess he's kind of a muttering, you know, mushmouth kind of speaking dog. What other talking dogs that are out there?
Because I guess all the dogs wanted eternal life, so they mechanized their bodies. They went to Planet Andromeda, which brings us to the next anime I have on my list here. The Galaxy Express 3-9 movie from 1979, directed by Rin Taro. And I could have chose Yamato. I didn't really want to double up on things that you had done in your previous list. I chose the Galaxy Express movie because it was a huge, huge hit in Japan. It was very influential. I think like a certain generation of anime creators active now, like Hosoda Mamoru, say like seeing this movie really inspired them to want to become animators. And it's like a space age fairy tale created by Leiji Matsumoto, kind of at the peak of his powers. Rin Taro, one of the greatest anime directors of all time, who doesn't get enough credit, I think, from people who are anime fans. fans who only go see the same five Ghibli movies over and over again. It kind of helped push anime out of sort of where it was at in terms of just like something that was for television only and into like theatrical films. It made so much money in Japan that like several distributors were kind of fighting for it to distribute it overseas.
Yes.
And Roger Corman of Death Race 2000 and Attack of the Crab Monsters fame got a hold of it and kind of mutilated it, but at least it was out there. The Galaxy Express movie to me is a really, really great film. It's got some incredible animation from Toei Films and stuff like that.
Profoundly, seriously, no joke, profoundly transformative. Like you said, it made anime a thing, or it made society at large aware that not only was the anime capable of being more than kids stuff, but that there was a big market of older fans who were willing to spend huge amounts of money on it. It's kind of the beginning of anime, not as a pastime, but anime as identity, if that makes sense. And I actually took a lot of heat from anime fans for centering the anime discussion in Pure Invention, my book, on Gundam and not on Galaxy Express, but which I can see, but you know, Gundam is influential in different ways, but 999, Galaxy Express 39 is definitely the OG when it comes to anime fandom, I think.
Yeah, I personally prefer the darker, grittier sequel, Ado Galaxy Express from 1981, but it doesn't make any sense unless you've seen the first one. So by all means,
Watch them both.
Good advice. Okay, number four on my list here, Matt. Golgo 13, The Professional.
It is not. Is it?
It is.
Oh, wow.
If an enemy becomes a problem, someone calls The Professional. Codename Golgo 13.
Target, former Nazi SS captain, Bernard Mueller.
I'll take the job.
He never kills for sport. He never misses the mark. And he never gets involved.
Can't you let this one go?
But this time, it's personal. The hunter has become the hunted. Because this time, he's the target.
We found Golgo 13. He's preparing to shoot, sir.
From 1983, directed by Osamu Dezaki, adapting the manga by Takao Saito, distributed in the U.S. by Streamline Pictures.
Osamu Dezaki of Mighty Orbots fame?
Not Jerry Orbach fame, Mighty Orbots.
He did direct that. It's a romp through the world of assassinations, I guess you would say.
Very adult animation, and also like kind of before even John Woo had done something like The Killer, it just has this kind of over-the-top, hyper-exaggerated gun action in it. You know, in its own way, it's as much a work of adult animation as something like Orosuke Doji, although it's like
Sure. Pushing
things more like kind of a James Bond action-adventure sort of mode. And it's quite a ride. It's one of these arguments for like, why did you need to tell this story in animation? This could have been a live-action film. But it's so exaggerated and such like a weird fever dream from like just drinking too much whiskey and reading too much Playboy magazine. And also, it shows off Dezaki's chops as a director because it's very dramatic and it's got all of his trademarks, like his big old freeze frames to kind of like, you know, knock you out of your seat and stuff like that.
Better or worse than the Nintendo Golgo 13 game by Vic Tokai, Patrick?
All the Golgo 13 incarnations out there, out of all the manga, all the OVAs, all the video games, this one really pulls my trigger softly and lovingly, Matt.
Like a diamond bullet to the brain, as Quentin Tarantino might say. Takao Saito, who did the original comic of Golgo 13. It goes way back to the 1960s and was hugely influential in like the student protest movement and stuff. He's probably the most successful of those 60s Gekiga creators, Gekiga being kind of the evolution of manga that's more oriented towards adults than towards kids that came out in the early 1960s. And it was a big movement back then. Arguably, most of the comic books we consume today are Gekiga, not manga. But Takao Saito is definitely the most successful out of those guys. And Golgo 13 is like, he's as iconic in Japan as James Bond is in the West, I think you can easily say.
Yeah, and Takao Saito actually did the James Bond manga adaptations in Japan. So there is a lot of James Bond DNA in Golgo 13 himself.
For sure. Next.
Okay, and for my final pick, Matt, I'm going to take you all the way back to 1985 for a strange biblical allegory directed by Mamoru Oshii called Angel's Egg.
Okay, I gotta say, I don't usually like making confessions. I've never seen Angel's Egg.
Well, that's it for the podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll have a new co-host next week. We're going to have Gogo 13, the professional here.
Pretend I've never seen it before, which won't take much pretending, and explain it to me. Explain Angel's Egg to me.
Strange, possibly post-apocalyptic, biblical allegory art film steeped in Christian symbolism, minimal dialogue. If you don't like art movies, stay away. You might think it's boring, but it's beautifully animated based on the art of Yoshitaka Amano. So ooh, it's gorgeous looking. And like all the kind of like weird art movie Tarkovsky influenced things you see in Oshii's other films like Ghost in the Shell, they're in the foreground here. And it blows my mind that this thing was even made and released.
Right.
It was distributed by Tokuma Shoten, but this was like 1985. This was the bubble economy. They could afford to just throw money at Mamoru Oshii to make a weird biblical allegory with art by Yoshitaka Amano. And I really wish that every year we'd get several of these, but that was not the case.
Yeah, I was going to say they don't make them like this anymore, but I think you really hit the nail on the head, which is that there was this period in Japanese anime that's known now as the OVA boom, original video animation. And it was a kind of direct to video. There was still anime on TV, of course, and in the theaters, but OVAs allowed creators to kind of appeal directly to fans and circumvent any of the kind of, I don't know, rules and strictures or whatever you wanted to call them that were on anime of, you know, that was televised, you know, or shown in theaters. And so you got a lot of weird stuff like that. And it was, I don't think a lot of Western anime fans realize why that happened. And you just said it. It's because it's bubble era and there's a lot of money coming in. And that money is coming in from Hollywood, which is paying Japanese studios to animate Saturday morning cartoons for American kids. And so they were just dumping what by American standards were not large amounts of money, but by Japanese anime industry standards, because the Japanese anime industry is a mess for a lot of reasons we can get into in a later episode, was huge money. And 85 is right around the time Transformers, the movie, came out, wasn't it? No, seriously, they're connected, because I don't know if Angel's Egg is specifically connected to this, but the amount of money that like Sunbow Productions or whatever was paying like per cell was something like no animator had ever heard of this amount of money. And like the smart ones were taking the money and banking it so they could make their own weird projects. And I don't know if Angel's Egg is specifically one of them, but it's definitely a benefactor of that kind of like, it's, you know, it's raining money period of the 1980s. May it happen again, because I'd like to see more weird stuff.
It's a genre that there aren't too many entries in, but the ones that are very precious to me, the anime head film, the purely psychedelic, take drugs and watch this movie kind of anime movie. And this is really it. And I think that's where I want to end my picks for quasi-essential, maybe essential to me, certainly, anime for the Showa era. And I guess next time I'll be doing kind of the Heisei to the present, and maybe there'll even be a Heisei burger thrown in there for good luck.
No, that's great stuff. I think the interesting thing about your picks is, you know, now anime to me, and I don't want to sound like one of those, like, I was into it before it was cool, man, guys, but I was. And the stuff that I was watching when I was a kid, is just, now it's all corporate franchises over and over again. Like all of the top anime are basically Shonen Jump series, and they're part of these giant media mix, you know, cross-platform strategies. But some of the stuff I like best was created outside of that, you know, framework.
There's this story you told me once that I really love, which is like you went to Harajuku Kiddyland to buy like a stuffed toy for someone, to buy like a stuffed animal.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, what kind do you want? And they said, what do you mean? I just want to get a stuffed toy. You tell the story.
So yeah, Hiroko and I went to a local toy store, you know, a big, you know, box. It was actually Yodobashi. It's known as Yodobashi Camera, but they actually have toy stores on every one. And Hiroko wanted to pick up like, I don't know, like a teddy bear or like a stuffed bunny rabbit for her niece. You know, it's just, there was her birthday coming up or something. And we go in there and just like you said, you know, Hiroko's like, oh, where's the stuffed animal section? And we go over there and it's all like, you know, Pikachus and, you know, like stuffed, like, you know, chainsaw man dogs or like whatever.
Character goods.
And Hiroko goes up to one of the employees and like, no, I'm just looking for like stuffed animals of like animals. And like, oh, we don't carry that. This is only character goods here.
Oh, they're extinct. They all died because of the polluted earth.
There must be a store in Japan somewhere where you can go and just get like a teddy bear, but apparently not Yodobashi. They have to be like cyborg bears from some cartoon.
So in Blade Runner 2023, like that's your ambition, is to like kill enough replicants to be able to afford a stuffed animal?
Is your owl real? Of course not, Patrick. He's a character item. Yes, we live in a corporate world, but you know what, something? There's also fun to be had in this hellscape. And one of those fun things is this podcast, I'd like to say. So thanks to everyone for listening.